Hi everyone, welcome to the show. Today is something special for me today. We're sitting down and having a conversation with Laura Meckler. She is a national writer for the Washington Post, but for this conversation, and especially locally, she is the author of the book Dreamtown, Shaker Heights and the Quest for Racial Equity. Welcome to the show, Laura, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'll admit, like when I first saw the book, I said, great, another book about Shaker Heights. And, you know, as a Shaker alum and someone that lives in the community, we tout those specials. Oh, did you see how we broke this barrier? And I'm like, yes, yes. But also knowing that there's sometimes some problems in Shaker. So I wasn't necessarily going to read it, but I'm glad I did.
Well, I'm glad you did too.
And I want to say, like, what I thought about the book and how it crossed into my life was that you tell the story from the beginning, as far back as you can go. And so, like, you mentioned the Van Swearingens and just the history buff, like the fact that there's a chapter about them. I was like, oh yeah, she knows this. Okay, like we're getting into the nitty gritty here. But you're a Shaker alum, correct?
Yes.
Okay. If I may ask, what elementary school did you go to?
I went to Sussex.
Okay.
So Sussex is now closed, but it's it was a school for many years.
Yes. And that name still actually rings true because I was voting the other day and someone was like, oh, you have to go to Sussex. And the person's like, where's that? And I'm like, Sussex? And I find out through the book, your elementary school, as you talk about as your neighborhood, is still iconic and it still means a lot to residents. For those of you that have not read the book, no spoilers. For those of you that are Shakerites, there are certain things in the book that you did that I just thought were so perfect and spoke to us. Like, and I listened to it on Audible, part of it. And it was when you opened up with the community is known by the school it keeps. And I'm like, oh, wow, like we're going there today. Like that, that was like, oh, okay. And so that was one. You talked about the familiar scent of the building. And I think that that still holds true. No matter when you left the school, elementary school or what have you, it still smells like you did when you were 6, 14, whatever age. For this book, why did you decide to trace it back so far? Because there's a lot of stories about Shaker Heights and they start in the 70s or with Ludlow. But why did you think it was important to start back from basically the beginning?
Yes. So great question. I thought it was essential really to tell this story from the beginning, starting with the Van Swearingens for a couple of reasons. To understand what came later, to understand who Shaker Heights is, what Shaker Heights is, what kind of a community is, what its values are, you have to understand how it started. And that is in two different ways. One, the Van Swearingens were creating what they thought of as a utopia, as sort of a perfect community, an aspirational place, a place of beauty, a place with gorgeous homes with the highest architectural standards, you know, with roads that curved and trees. And it is all of that. And it is, and that's part of what makes Shaker a place that people want to live in and want to be in, and because it is a beautiful community. And they really did succeed in doing that. And it's also, it was always viewed as kind of elite community. And that's how some people view Shaker as well. But it was also, the other part that's just as important is that it was an exclusive community, and they made very clear both who they wanted and who they did not want. And, you know, there were covenants on the deeds, which were restrictions on who you could sell to. Now, in some communities, they were explicit about who you could not sell to. You could not, they would say you can't sell to Black people, to Jews, to Catholics, to people of Chinese descent. There were a whole different set of arrays depending on where you were. In Shaker, it was more subtle. You had to get permission from the Van Swearingen company to sell your home. And those permissions, by the way, were still being enforced into the 60s. Everyone kind of knew who it was meant to keep out. Now, it was often said that it was meant to keep out Blacks, Jews, and Catholics, although there were quite a few Jews who did get in those early years in the 20s. I found a lot of Jewish families, just happenstance in the course of my research, who moved their grandparents or what have you arrived in the 20s. But that was not the case for Black families. They could not get in. And when they tried, they were shut down and driven out. So to understand what happened next, which was a really remarkable move and embrace of integration in the sort of the next chapter of the book, literally and figuratively, the next chapter of the community, you really need to understand where it began.
Yeah. And I think for me, it was understanding that those laws did keep out others besides just Black people. You know, normally when we think about race or exclusions, it's always been Black and white. you know, and we don't hear necessarily a lot about Jewish families being excluded. And to think about Jewish families being excluded in a city like Shaker Heights today, I mean, just that piece alone is a little mind blowing for me. And you know, as you talk about the book and you talk about how the races moved in, I will say, like, my family and my grandmother lives on the other side of the barricades, literally. You tell a story about when that street wasn't barricaded, and that's all I know is those barricades that go along Scottsdale. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother lived on the other side of that street, which is Invermere in Cleveland. And so I've heard the story even from our family circles about how we moved into Shaker Heights as a kid, because I moved in when I was 7, and the struggles and the conversations my mom had to go through. But I think the other thing that stood out to me in the book was it wasn't just the Van Swearingen's laws and rules that kept people out, you know, like the real estate agents and the bankers. And like, there was a bigger chunk of the play, you know, at play of trying to, number one, encourage white people to move away and create fear, but also stop Black people from moving in, even if they got past the Van Swearingen rules. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And by the way, I grew up on Scottsdale. That was the street I grew up on. So I was also very familiar with the barricades, and we can talk about those later maybe. And also, I just want to say one other thing about what you just said. I will get to your question, that it is true that these restrictions did keep other people out too. It did. It was harder for Jewish families to move in. But I just want to also acknowledge, as someone who's Jewish myself, that it's not the same. Like, it's not the same. There were exceptions made, and there were Jews who did get in, and that just wasn't the same for Black families. And I think we just need to be honest about, like, the fact that even though there were was discrimination, you know, aplenty in the society, you know, and obviously, you know, Jews have been subjected to enormous discrimination over history, but it was not the same in this community. And I just think we just need to be honest.
Absolutely.
To the question that you asked, which now I have forgotten what it is.
It was about the community of, like, conspirators to keep Black people out, or to help white people move away.
It was the whole system. It was this was not random. This was not just here and there. This wasn't just random prejudices of people. Oh, I don't want this one guy doesn't want, or people in general didn't want to sell to Black people. It was not that. It was the system. There were, for instance, banks would not lend to you if you were a Black family trying to buy into a white neighborhood. Banks would not write the loan. I mean, I talked to people in Black families, the earliest ones who moved into Ludlow, and that's what they faced. They had to go to other banks. They had to go to Black-owned bank to get a loan. In fact, one of the first, if not the very first family to buy in the Shaker community was the Mason family. When they bought, they got a loan from a Black-owned bank. And then soon after that, the head or somebody who worked at Shaker Savings and Loan called in the husband of this family and his banker from Quincy Bank, this Black-owned bank, for a meeting in his office to say, what are you doing making this loan? I mean, let's just stop and think about that for a
crazy.
Second. It sounds insane.
Like, you're going to call the president of another bank and ask them, how dare you, basically. Like, I that mean, was true
this
audacity.
This guy has, like, absolutely no part in this transaction. This is none of his business, okay? Like, in any way. But he viewed it as his... He was entitled to do this. So, like, these rules were enforced by the system, okay? The banking system and the realty system also. Now, today, you want to buy a house, you can go onto a website and you can see all the stuff that's for sale in any zip code in the country from the, you know, from your computer. But it wasn't that way back in the day. What it was you needed a realtor to tell you what was for sale, and or see a for sale sign. But to see a house, you needed a realtor, and the realtors were segregated. There were the realtors, which were the white people, and the realists, mm-hmm. who were the Black brokers. And so if you were Black, you had a Black broker, and they did not have access to the listings that from the white realtors. So this whole system was set up that way, and it was to break into it required an enormous amount of effort and toughness. And then it was, I will say, I mean, we haven't really gotten to this part of the story, but just to hint what to come, which is that once a neighborhood became integrated, which was the case first in Ludlow, once the first Black families moved in, then the system flips. And it is now looking to resegregate as quickly as possible, mm-hmm. to scare the white people into leaving. Now it's the white people who can't get loans because suddenly this neighborhood is quote unquote risky. And now it's the white brokers who are telling white clients, oh, you don't want to move there. The whole system is just set up
yes.
to to encourage segregation.
And I think, you know, reading this book, one of the things that's stuck out to me as a Black person is I didn't know or I've never seen the other side of the resegregation. So like, I know that the houses go for sale, but I don't know that maybe you're getting mail saying you should move, or to the point of how they resegregate the neighborhood. You know, for me, it's one of those things that just happens, like, oh, wow, all these Black people just seem to be moving in, because people don't tell you that's why they're moving. You know, to a chagrin falls. They're like, oh, we need a little more land, or it's always something else. Yeah. So the idea of resegregation was just like,
and it was, you know, there were some of these white people who would flee, white flight. Some of them, I'm sure, had, you know, their own deep prejudices and they were on their way out. Other people, I think, were just genuinely scared. They were scared. They would do things called blockbusting, where realtors would like knock on your door at all days of the week. They would call you and they would say, like, You want to sell? You better sell. Mm-hmm. This whole neighborhood is going to be Black in 3 years. You'll be the last family here. You're going to lose all your money. I mean, they would just terrify people. And so if you're a white person who isn't inclined to move, and you got all your money in this house and people are telling you you're going to lose it all, like, you might get pushed into selling too. So that's what I mean by, and I think that's when we talk about systemic racism, that's what it is. It is the system doing it, and it is pushing it to everybody.
Yeah. And I think even now we see it happening full circle, like on the street I live in. Now I'm getting inundated with mail because now they want to buy the house because our neighborhood is starting to change back a little. And it's just interesting to see that and to realize it happens above. And so near the Shaker Town Center.
Yep. So how is the neighborhood changing?
So here's the fun thing. I used to live at the Lomond Sussex border. It was a nice mixed street, you know, everything that we think of the neighborhood. And then I moved back to my childhood home, and it's like night and day. You wouldn't think it's the Lomond neighborhood. We'll just say it that way. And so it's a lot of rental properties, you know, two family homes. The street was basically all Black, and it just was a different neighborhood. And now we're seeing, you know, more white people on the street. Like, not to say, like, you can see, like, you've got more decorations and more, it's just a different, the houses are being like renovated really quickly. And then, you know, white families are moving in and the mail is like, sell, sell, sell. We can give you cash for your house. Sell, sell, sell. And so it's happening the same way as it's going back to what it was when I first moved in as a kid. I just think it's fascinating how that cycle still continues, even though we say like it's done, or, you know, those are the past days. It's not really. But as we keep going on, we talk about the Masons and we talk about Ludlow. You know, I think about how I've been told that story, and basically who tells you the story, it's a different story. So when white families or someone, a white historian from Shaker, tells me the story of Ludlow, we don't focus on the Black family that moved in. They're almost nameless. There was a Black family that moved in and the community welcomed them. But your story's not like that.
Well, I tried to tell the story from a lot of different points of view. In fact, so each chapter in the book is anchored by a different person, or in some cases, pair of people. And you learn the story from their perspective while we kind of move the overall story forward. In the case of Ludlow, actually, I thought this was such an important story. There are actually two chapters, one of which is anchored by a Black couple and one of which is anchored by a white couple. So you do somewhat see it from those two different points of view. The interesting thing to me about the Ludlow story that I never heard growing up, because I also heard about this story, and there was all this pride associated with this, and I think rightfully so. It was a remarkable thing that Black and white families together did to fight those systemic factors that we were just discussing a minute ago. But what I never heard about, and what I don't think was ever talked about, was that the whole thing was inherently discriminatory, because what it was doing was saying, the system's going to bring more Black people in this neighborhood. We want to keep it integrated, so we need to bring white people. So all the incentives, all the marketing, all of the focus was about keeping and drawing white families to the neighborhood. They were aware of the fact that that was, you know, uncomfortable, and they made peace with it because they said that, you know, there were all these other factors that were pushing in the other direction. They were just trying to be a countervailing force. Still, especially for Black families living in the neighborhood, that was hard, because they had to tell their own friends and family, don't move here. And it's not, at that time, we're talking in the late 50s into the 60s, through the 60s, there weren't that many options. It wasn't like, oh, you have 17 places to move, pick one of the others. It was that they didn't. They had just a handful, maybe one, maybe two places. This is one of the few neighborhoods that was open, as they called it, to Black buyers. So they had to tell their own families sometimes, don't come. And that was painful. And the same thing applied as this housing program spread through the other neighborhoods in Shaker. The same tensions were there and ultimately blew up, you know, years later when there was a lot of dissatisfaction with this because there was really only focus on drawing white people.
Yeah. And I think the one thing that was, I think that's still true. Like, I feel that we know that if too many of one move in, the neighborhood changes. So no matter what side you're on, you have to keep a balance. But what I thought was interesting is how often the people that were turned away understood why they were turned away. But it was like, but not for me, though. Like, yeah, absolutely. We don't want a lot of Black people in our neighborhood as a Black person. But what about me? Like, I'm not like there's still a me versus them. So a lot of the protests, the people seem to understand why, and they were moving for the integration, but they didn't want to be the one that couldn't come. And I thought that was something that came across in almost every neighborhood that you talked about sometimes.
Which is understandable. We Absolutely. All kind of want what we want. Although there were some exceptions. Like, for instance, I think of Irvin Thomasine Mason, who was the brother of Ted Mason, who mm-hmm. was that first family. They actually did move into the Onaway neighborhood, and it was all white at the time. And they had to go to court to enforce the contract, because the family that sold to them very consciously sold to a Black family. They were connected through a program that was for that very purpose, to integrate neighborhoods. But then the neighbors were mad and pressured them to try to revoke the sale, which they then attempted to do. And it went to court, and ultimately they were allowed to move in. And guess what? Everything was fine once they moved in. Mm-hmm. It was ugly, and they were really brave to do that. You know, and they said, okay, we're not going to move to Ludlow, where the brother who he was extraordinarily close with lives. We're going to go, you know, of course it's not, we know Onaway is not that far from Ludlow. Right. It's, you know,
other side of the tracks,
five minute drive, but it was a different world, a different situation.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I used to always say, as I leave Shaker and I'm an adult now, I said, I always feel like I was raised by like hippies, taught by like hippies or like the freedom riders. And so as we talk about, I said, these people were like people that would do that. And they were very much about social justice. And when you read this book, you think about the allyship that existed, where you had white families saying, no, I want to sell to a Black family, or we'll purchase and then transfer the title. And so, you know, I do want to just put in a plug that there was allyship, and in many cases, it wouldn't have moved as quickly or as easily, although it wasn't easy at all, without that kind of
100%
on both sides of the, you know, both commitment on both sides to do this.
Can I give my favorite example of this, actually? Yes. of allyship, which is that, so now we've been talking about housing, but a big part of the Shaker story is of course schools. And when the superintendent who arrived in the mid 60s, Jack Lawson, he decided that he wanted to do a school integration desegregation program. And he was very ahead of the curve. There was no court order. This was a time when a lot of communities were fighting this, and he wanted to do it and worked to make this happen. However, his proposal was for a one-way busing plan. This is for the elementary schools, which was the kids from Moreland, which is a 88% Black school at the time, were going to be, half of them were going to be bused to the overwhelmingly or majority white schools. And it was just going to be a one-way program. And he was going to use the space in Moreland for this special services school, like enrichment programming, mm-hmm. which I think he was very committed to. But here's the thing. Before he even announced this program, Black families, Black parents in Moreland said, we do not want a one-way program. We do not want one-way busing. And he proposed it anyway. And they said it again after it was proposed. We oppose. They were very active in opposing it. And he was just pushing through with it. Then white families in Shaker spoke up, and they said, after a few months, they said, you know, why are we just doing this one way? The white schools are just as segregated, if not more, than Moreland is. And we, not only did they speak up in favor of a two-way cross enrollment program, but they volunteered their own kids to be part of it. And once they did that, that's when the plan changed, and it mm-hmm. became a two-way busing plan. I just would make two observations about that. Like, one is that this is an example of allyship, of where the white families were lend their voices and their power to what the Black families had been saying for months. And we can see, you know, I mean, put more charitably, they would say that they didn't think two-way would work because there would be too much opposition, and they showed that there wouldn't be so much opposition. But uncharitably, we can say that the people with the power spoke up, and then that's when it changed. But the other point I want to make about, and this is a larger point about the book, which is that I feel like a lot of stories that get told about schools and even race or even just America in general are either, hey, look at this beautiful shining example of how perfect everything worked, and don't you wish you could be like them? Or look at how this failed. This was a complete disaster. And there's not, and that's really not how most of life is. Most of us live in the messy middle. And this book is really not about like heroes and villains, but basically good people trying to make progress and also making mistakes. And that's a good, Jack Lawson is a good example of it. That superintendent, he did push the ball forward. He does get a lot of credit. He was very foresighted, and he had this huge blind spot, you know? So both of those can be true at the same time.
Yeah. Like there's so much I want to unpack, because I really learned a lot from the book just about neighborhoods and misconceptions that I held. We could go deep into the Moreland neighborhood, but I know I want to really want to get into the schools. But the Moreland neighborhood, I'll say, my mom told me this story that when we moved, or when she was moving into Shaker, the realtors only wanted to show her Moreland. And she kept saying, no, I want to go on the other side of Lee Road, the other side of Lee Road. And they wouldn't, you know, okay, fine, Lindholm. And she's just like, why can't this was wait, like 85, 86.
Jeez. Oh my God. This is disturbing.
And so, and like I said, she grew up on the other side of the barricade. So she knew that she wanted to stay on the same side of Lee Road, you know, by Warrensville Heights or what have you. And over there. And finally, I think she changed realtors a couple times to get to where we got. And so as you're telling the story of the book, I'm like, oh, wow. So, there, you know, there's still a system at play. And I think what I took away from this book was how much of my life has been determined based on some of these things that were in play. And I didn't realize that. Like, I had a conversation with someone a few years ago, and I was like, oh, yeah, I started learning French when I was in elementary school. And they look at me like, you know French? And I'm like, yeah. And then I'm reading the book. I'm like, of course I know, because I went to Lomond. You know, like, that's why I know French. If I had gone to Moreland or Sussex, I wouldn't know French. I would have picked up a different language. And I just thought that was so interesting to feel somehow like, in some ways, that some of the things that happened to me in a good way were chosen because of some of these people that we're talking about in the book, because of some of these fights and some of these stands they made to say, like the Jack Lawson, let's put programs in all the schools. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, that's why I know this. And then also you talk about the part when they rearranged the schools and the conversation of closing buildings. Mm-hmm. And that was a major part of my life too, because I was that class that got sent to Woodbury as a fifth grader, the first class. And so that was a special moment. And again, my mom told me the story of which elementary schools do we close. And to the point that you made earlier about people standing up or Shaker always not always doing the obvious decision. She told me a story of that meeting where she was like, they're going to close Lomond and keep Sussex open. And she went to that parent meeting and there was, you know, just anger and upsetness and we pay more taxes. And, you know, she said, I walked out of there thinking Shane is going to have to go to a different school next year. Then all of a sudden the letter came and we're keeping Lomond open. And she said, because we had a great association. And I didn't understand the point of the associations. But I think to your point of all of this to say, you know, Shaker makes hard choices. And I'm not like I'm an alum, but I'm not like, oh, Shaker's always great. You know, they make good choices. And I think, you know, through your book, you see that the community is trying to work together as a community. And I don't think that always happens in many other places.
I agree 100%. My ultimate conclusion of this book is that while they have not achieved what they've set out to achieve, and there are problems, that it is ultimately a success story because it is still a place that's committed to trying and is still working to move this ball forward. So yes, I agree with what you said there 100%. There's another interesting little wrinkle to that school closing situation, which was in 1987. And they ended up closing 4 of the 9 elementary schools. And it was cast at the time as a very even-handed decision. So there were 2 majority white schools that were closed, Sussex, where I went, which is next to Lomond, and Malvern, which is actually actually the in the wealthiest part of Shaker.
Mm-hmm.
There were two majority Black schools closed, Ludlow and Moreland. And then they redrew the lines and all the schools were racially balanced. So it was viewed very progressively. However, you know, and I always kind of viewed it that way too, to be perfectly honest. But when I was working on this book, I thought about it a little more deeply and thought about, well, yes, it was, quote, even because two of each. On the other hand, there were only three majority Black schools and six majority white schools. And two of the three Black schools, majority Black schools, were closed. Two of the six majority white schools were closed. So it wasn't really even. Furthermore, the big problem with that, which no one really talked about at the time, I talked to people who were involved who were really pretty progressive in their thinking, and people weren't really talking about this, was the fact that the kids in Moreland, who are the poorest kids in Shaker, were bused the farthest to Mercer. So
absolutely.
And that's a problem that the community is going to wrestle with, I think, in the near future, because there's been a lot of conversation about that. It's a very, for anyone who knows the geography of Shaker, you know that solving this problem is going to be challenging if you still want racially integrated elementary schools, because the east side of Shaker is majority white and, you know, pretty strongly so. So you got to get some Black kids there if you want it racially balanced. And if you're going to have a school out there, which they've committed to doing. So someone's going to get bust. And so then it's like, well, who's going to do it? Are you going to bus kids from Lomond who have their mm-hmm. own school, take them out of their own neighborhood? It's a very complicated puzzle. And I'll be curious to see how they grapple with it.
Same.
So anyway, it's not easy. This is not going to be an easy problem. And it wasn't an easy problem then. I think the whole story just speaks to the fact that, you know, these things are multifaceted and difficult, and things that can look very fair and even when you look at them one way can look a little bit less so if you look at them in another way. So that's sort of life.
Yeah. And I think about how, you know, the stereotypes of the schools that exist now. So even if, let's say I was a Mercer family that lived near Mercer, but as a Black student or Black children, people still think you must be a Moreland kid because you're Black and going to Mercer, where you may literally live across the street from Mercer and vice versa. And I remember when my own children were going to Lomond, they were calling it the poor school. And we lived on we would have been a street or two over to be bused from Sussex. So we were right there on that border. And it's just, you know, the stereotypes that those schools still carry as we still try to label, you know, where Black students are, where Black kids are. And I know we're just running out of time and there's so much that we could really, you know, get into. I think the question I would have for you, though, is number one, as Shaker still continues to work towards this, do you think that they're going to make gains, or is it still going to always be a struggle for Shaker Heights?
Probably yes and yes.
Okay.
I think they will make gains. I mean, right now they're in the midst of a very big change, which is detracking, which is to collapsing kids of multiple ability levels into the same classes, which is an effort to try to essentially desegregate the classrooms. The class placement has been so racially stratified. And they're working through that, and it is a struggle, and they are taking it on. You know, we'll see how it does. If it succeeds, we will end up with more kids of all races reaching higher academic levels. And that would be a really good thing if that is what the result is. We'll see. We'll see what it looks like. But you know what? I don't know if these problems, challenges, call them what you will ever be solved. I don't know that there's any, like, you know, this idea of a utopia actually, like, courses through all of Shaker history from back to the Shakers themselves, the religious sect that first occupied the territory. They were out to build a utopia, their own version of what a utopia mm-hmm. looks like. And the Van Swearengens had their vision, and the Ludlow pioneers had their vision. And people today have visions of this too, but it's never going to be perfect. I don't think, not in this country, and, you know, not with our history, but I do think that they will continue working towards it. I think that it's a community that really has a lot of people in it who are committed to it. Doesn't mean everybody agrees all the time, but the overall, there is a critical mass of people who are interested in making progress. That's my sense. I'd be curious for your answer to the same question.
The detracking statement, like, I've been always curious of that, because what it becomes is, from the, you know, the Black side of being a Shaker resident. You want your kid in that class. You're fighting for your kid. Personally, like, I pulled my daughter out of Shaker schools in middle school because they were trying to pull her out of a track. And I remember saying to the person that was the middle school principal at the time, she's gone through this school since kindergarten. You know, almost like a how dare you, that in that Shaker way that we talk, because they're like, well, she's not ready for advanced math. She doesn't know how to do something. And it was something so complex and convoluted. Like, there's no way, who does this? Like, she can't add quickly, you know, 1 + 4 = 7, 4 17ths minus 3 6/3. And you're like, who does that though? You know, and I was teaching at the school and they kept trying to pull her out. She's not ready to go on. She's not ready to go on. And I'm like, this is like insane and crazy that we're fighting this and she's not prepared and maybe she shouldn't. I'm like, she came out of kindergarten through this. Like, this is your student. You know, like, I know that you say these throwaway statements, as I call them, to people that maybe move in later or those things, but this is one of yours and she's never had a problem. And that's how she ended up leaving the schools, was because I knew that that road of people trying to move her out of advanced classes was going to persist. And it hurt my soul, I think. But what I like what you just said was that Shaker's history and continues of this pursuit of whatever utopia may be. The Shakers didn't exactly get it right, if you know the Shakers, but the Vance Warringtons had their own idea. And I think Shaker, in its integration space or racial equity space, is still trying to find that utopia. So I feel like Shaker Heights in some ways is chasing this idea of what is the utopia. And it's something that continues to, you know, run throughout the people. That's the Shaker way, so to speak, our utopia. I would love to see them get there that way. And I believe that as we think about it on a national scale, I think Shaker is still going to play a major part of that. Shaker still dealing with all the other problems that you're talking about in the book, you know, the massive, the white flight, or the massive influx of students that want better from a school district and better for their children. Like, I'm rooting for Shaker and I hope Shaker gets there. It depends on a lot of the other systemic things that we've been talking about. So,
well, 100%. And that's such an upsetting story about your daughter. And it says, just, I'm really upset to hear that story. And I'm also not surprised, because basically every Black parent, student, alum who I've spoken to has a story, at least one like that. And I think that that is the problem that has been the problem for a long time. And why do they not? They've got an involved, bright parent in front of them with a kid. And obviously, I don't know what your daughter's academics were, but it doesn't matter. She wants to try. Let her try, let her go, let her push her, make her, and you have a kid who wants to be an advanced, great. That should be the response. How can we support her? How can we get her what she needs so she will succeed in this class? Not how can we force her into a lower class? I mean, that is just so tragic that was happening, and it was happening for a lot of kids, and it's upsetting. And I hope that they, you know, I mean, obviously, I think what happened with the detracking is they basically figured out that, like, we evidently are not capable of doing this in any other way because right. of stories like the one that you just told, which I think everyone should be really unsettled by. And I can't help but wonder that if the exact same situation were to unfold with a white parent and a white kid who was saying, I want her to be an advanced, you know, despite whatever it is that you're saying. And I want to try, if they would not have accommodated them more easily. And obviously I don't know, but I certainly wonder.
Yeah. And I would answer that, but not here, just because I was working in the schools at the time. And so I saw how those placements were being made and how kids were being moved. And I would hear the conversations of parents saying how they were going to get their kid into whatever class. And I do want to touch on, like, as we're talking about some of those stories, I told you right before we started, like, there were some chapters that were hard for me to finish this book because of the statement, like you said, like your daughter said, and she loves where she went to school. She went to a private school in Shaker Heights and she loves it, but she'll often say, like, I don't have that same frame of reference as me and her brother who graduated from Shaker. There are some stories about, you mentioned Aisha Bell Hardaway, and she's a year older than me, so I knew who she was. And you tell a story of, I think maybe it was an English teacher. And I just stopped, like, and put the book down. And I was like, we're never going to get this interview done, because it brought up the time when I was like, I dropped a class. The teacher handed me a slip to go see my counselor to drop out of her advanced English class in 12th grade. It's a scar that, like I said, I still carry. And I've written about it here at Black Girl in Cleveland. I've told even colleagues at like other news associations that this story, and they're like, that happened to you? And I'm like, yeah. And that's why like I podcast, or I barely write, because someone told me, one of the teachers told me, like, you'll never be a good writer. You write like an elementary school student. And she said, you write like someone that should be at Woodbury. It was one of my favorite stories, like the story I had turned in like right in August, like first day back from summer, like any kind of creative writing. Like, it's the only story I put a lot of work into. And I didn't realize the scar that carried till I got to college. And my college professor said, who told you you can't write? She says, you write mm-hmm. like someone who's scared to write. And it's still like, we do a lot of things here at Black Girl for people that have gone through that experience. Like, do you have writing anxiety? Like, let's write mm-hmm. together. How do we bring you together so that you can be ready to write? And I, because of that experience, I think like offer people a chance to write here that, you know, I don't care if you don't even spell right, like we can fix it. Just come start writing. And so when you tell the story about Aisha and you say the teacher didn't remember the comment, I'm sure she didn't, because it wasn't an important comment. But I'm sure for someone like Aisha or someone like me or any other students that go through that, like that scar is something that they carry with them. And it's probably how I ended up pulling my daughter, because I felt that scar like, oh no, we're not going to do this. And so I think, you know, I thank you for even telling some of the unpretty parts here.
Yeah. The follow-up interview with the teacher was illuminating. I think I would just have, you know, people can read it for themselves, but she said a lot of things that made it clear that there was a lot of bias. You know, this was probably not the only time that that happened. So,
and I actually had that teacher.
And, you know, I actually have that teacher as well. I did too. I think one of the things that was resonant for me was the fact that my experience was so different. And, you know, I'm sure that that's not a coincidence that, you know, obviously I'm of a different race. Anyway, I'm really sorry that that happened to you. And I'm glad you're writing now. Oh, well, maybe you're not
writing. As we podcast.
You're podcasting. Well, you're communicating. That's for sure. I'm really sorry to hear that. But I hope there was at least some affirmation for you.
So. Well, I think it's the affirmation of you illuminating that in the book. And then when we get into the chapter of Jody Podol and we think about, like I said, the vitriol I saw in that school board meeting. And what you just said was the same kind of thing, where the white family seemed to say, we've never had that reaction or heard something like that from this teacher. And the Black families were like, oh, absolutely, happens all the time. And it was in that moment to me where like it all came together in a just public display, which is not something Shaker does well, as we don't really do public displays like that. And so to illuminate that in your book, like, I thank you for that, because it shows that there are two sides. And it's still happening. And when you think about, you know, Aisha Bell Hardaway is, I think, in the Hall of Fame, and she's an amazing lawyer, professor. She does so many amazing things, but that she had to go through that. And so it's not that she's not a good writer or not a good communicator, because we know that she is. Right. But there was just something else, you know, some baggage or discrimination or whatever feelings that were happening there. Before I let you go, this book, Dreamtown, is the talk of the town in Shaker. And I've seen it so many times in my class. Before our reunion is going to read it together. Oh, what do nice. You think the current community, how should we take away from this book? Because there's a lot of times where we all get this, you know, we discuss it. We go, wow, that was illuminating. We should do something. And then the discussion is the it. Or like, what do you want the takeaway or the next steps to be after reading this book?
Well, I don't have a specific like agenda item of like particular things to do. That's for people who live there and who are doing mm-hmm. in it day to day to figure out. But my takeaway is that this is the reason Shaker has had the successes that it has had is because of people who have been committed to it over a very long period of time. And so I would say that it's exactly what you said, talking about it and coming together to figure out like, where are the answers and how do we find them together? And I think that and maintaining the commitment toward something better and that quest is the subtitle of the book says, it's a quest. It isn't something, it's not a race that you run and then you're at the end. It's a quest that you are on for maybe a long time. But I would say, I guess what I would hope people would take away from it is a desire to be part of the solution and to be part of the conversation and to be thinking about what needs to happen next and how can they support progress and find a way to make this community continue to work for everybody. It's a special place, you know, and it's a place that matters to me. I brought to this work both the dispassionate take of a journalist trying to look at it with clear eyes, but also the heart of somebody who cares about it. And that's what I hope other people will do too, which is bring their own hearts and their own selves into this conversation about how to make a place that is in many ways so unusual in this country that we live in, where most of the people are just with other people who are like them, you know, rich people with rich people, poor people with poor people. And that's just the way it is. And this is a place that has both racial and economic diversity. And that gives you a level of at least a step towards equity and towards justice that you don't necessarily see in that many other places. So appreciate that. And think about how you can be part of the progress. I describe in the book that there's almost a metaphorical baton that has been passed from person to person and generation to generation over the years. And I think of the characters in my book as passing that baton from one person to the next. I feel like maybe you can think about what can I do to help pick up that baton.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you for your time. As you said that, I was thinking about Lomond's school song where they go like, is Lomond proud of me? Because that's something that is ingrained in us as we go forward. And we always hear about what an amazingly special place Shaker is. And as kids, you roll your eyes and like, yay, high school. But as I get older, I realize it is a unique mix that you don't find other places. For people that have not read the book, if you are an alum or a resident, I'll say that the book is familiar, sometimes hard. It's emotional, but it's nostalgic. So when you mention like a Mr. McIntyre and score, like those are great memories for me. But also, you know, it gets into the grit of it. And so I'm just super thankful for you writing this book. And I'm super thankful that you took the time to talk to me today. Absolutely. Is there anything before we go that you wish that we had talked about in this interview that we didn't touch on?
You know, there, I think we covered a lot. There's okay. Just so much you know, we could probably, you and I could probably talk about this for, you know, for hours and not get bored, but maybe I think we hit a lot of points.
All right.
So thank you so much for reading it, for thinking about this stuff, for inviting me onto your show and for this really thoughtful conversation. I really appreciate it.
Great. My guest today was Laura Meckler, the author of Dreamtown, Shaker Heights, and The Quest for Racial Equity. Thanks for your time, and everyone else. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.